Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Breitall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 181 for comics originally released on January 26, 2011. We're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to talk about our Marvel comic first because we simply cannot wait to talk about this. And by which I mean we're actually recording this early because both Bob and I couldn't wait and got a spare copy off the racks for this because we're, of course, talking Fantastic Four 587.
I knew that there was no way I was going to make it all the way to my DCBS box without having this spoiled somewhere for me. So I preempted that by going and picking up a copy and reading it on the Wednesday it came out.
I did the same thing, but it took me until the Thursday to get a copy. We're actually recording this part of the discussion right after we recorded Weekly Comic Spotlight 180. We'll record the DC and other section next weekend. But I was pretty sure I wasn't going to be able to hold off on the spoilers as long as it would take for my copy to get here. Unfortunately, the first store I went to was sold out, so I had to go to... I tried to go to one near where I work, and that just didn't pan out. So, of course, I went to the ever-reliable and ever-great store of Tribe Comics. And they, of course, hooked me up as I expected. And, again, they're a great store. Much appreciated. So, I want to start off by saying that I am not a fan of the polybagging of comics. I'm not a fan of the overhyping of stories. I did appreciate that once I got it out of the bag, that the cover itself didn't spoil the ending. You know, and I guess we need to decide right now of, are we going to discuss who dies or not?
You know, it's going to be, well, who appears to die? Or not, because I have a large question on like whether anybody actually died or not.
I don't have a question, but I agree. It's more of it is an appearance, not a death, and that annoyed me. But yes,
now we can leave it
vague.
At
that? Okay,
I guess you know. Let me start out by saying I love Hickman's run. There are on FF. There are detractors to his run. You know, I've seen, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I've been reading Fantastic Four for a long time, and I don't know why everyone's so excited about Hickman, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The first issue of Fantastic Four I bought was number 97. So I've been reading Fantastic Four a long time, and I am loving this run. I am thinking it's one of the top five runs on FF ever. And a lot of it has to do, for me personally, with just the characterization he has had of Valeria and Franklin. Valeria is probably my favorite character in the book, and I would not have thought that, you know, 2 years ago. You know, like, oh, Valeria Richards is just there, right? But he's really brought her to life, you know, for me, and he's done an excellent job of it. And that said, I think this issue... was a great issue, and it was a great conclusion to the story arc that's been going on. But what really, really detracted from it is nothing to do with the issue itself or the writing. It's Marvel's marketing machine. And yeah, they're overhyping this book and getting the whole woo-woo, a death, somebody dies, you know, and just, you know, heck. You see a dead body laying on the steps that's been riddled with bullets, and the person's going to come back. You know, so I have a kind of jaded attitude on comic book deaths in general. But when they kind of give the appearance of a death, and they don't actually concretely show, you know, it's kind of like the, you know, the old thing of comic book deaths. You know, someone like the car goes off the cliff, and you know. Then
I'm not even sure they went that far. Right. I think they showed the car heading towards the cliff,
right,
not necessarily going off the cliff.
But I'm just saying, it's like, you know, those old Saturday morning serials.
Classic where, cliffhanger. That's where the definition comes
from. And you'd come, and then they'd show why something happened where he didn't really die. It just appeared that he died.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't have a problem with that. Because personally, you know they're going to bring the person who died back. And we're theorizing that it's going to be in number 600 after they, you know, stop this series, have the FF series for a year, and then retitle it back to Fantastic Four for number, you know, 600. Personally, I much rather have, oh, well, they never actually really died, and here's what really happened, you know, kind of thing, than them coming up with some nonsensical traveling through time kind of stuff like Captain America, you know, to have them in a very confusing way that I still don't understand, you know, bring somebody back to life. You know, I don't have a problem with that. It's just like, well, you thought they died, but you didn't see the body, so they didn't really die. That is playing fairer in my mind than actually showing the death on screen on panel and then reneging on it.
That's where Hickman did a good job, but got a huge disservice from the marketing machine at Marvel. Because
absolutely,
the way that character's story in this issue ends off, and we should refer to it as that character just to keep it completely ambiguous like we've decided, sets up for a doesn't look so good, death could happen, but not even a death will happen. Again, going to that classic cliffhanger definition from the old serials, what would happen is you would have the stagecoach in the Western running towards the cliff. It looks like it goes over. You even see the thing go splatter in the gorge or whatever. Come back next week for the next part of the serial, you get that same thing, but now, right before it goes over, you get a cut to the other side where you see the stagecoach driver, you know, bailing out, rolling into the tumbleweeds as the thing goes over. Oh, he's okay. You know, we don't even need that here because the situation is set up that, sure, you know, metaphorically it was heading towards the cliff. We never see it go over. Yeah. There are assumptions made as the only reason people are thinking a character died here is because Marvel's been telling us one was going to die for months.
Exactly, because it's been hyped as a death issue. And, you know, otherwise you wouldn't even think that, you know, from this. It would be like, oh, how is that character going to get out of this one? Doesn't look very good for him, you know.
And if it hadn't been hyped this way, my expectation for the next issue would be basically it is going to be an action-packed, oh my god, fight scene starring that character. And it's just going to blow our socks off because, of course, it's Hickman, it's great art, whatever. And it's just going to be a really, you know, blockbustery kind of an issue, whereas...
Or even if they delayed that by, you know, because the way that it's set up, it is ambiguous that the other members of the team think that the character has, in fact, died, right?
And that's fair. They could put off the grand
fight for a while. You know, so they could put that off for a while. And I don't have a problem with that either. You know, it's just, again, it's just the marketing hype around this has really done a disservice to this story.
Exactly.
And it's nothing that is Hickman's fault. I mean, Hickman crafted a great issue, great art, some really excellent moments in this issue, very well done. And it just, you know, makes me sad that the, you know, Marvel marketing did what they did. However, that said, you know, what Marvel marketing did do was they created what I'm going to, and not that much of a stretch, predict is going to be the number one book of the month and is going to sell significantly more copies than any other issue of Hickman's run of Fantastic Four.
Well,
they're going to make a boatload of money off of what they did, and that's their job, right?
That's their job, but they're doing it at short-term gain for long-term expense because they've burned a lot of goodwill. I think this is not only going to be the top seller for January, it's probably going to be it by a wide margin, maybe even a 2-to-1 margin over the next best-selling issue, which if I had to guess, I'm kind of leaning towards that Iron Man 500 we talked about in the last Weekly Comic Spotlight. Right now, though, because of how they've hyped it, if we ever get a this is what really happened to that character after, you know, we last saw them, it's going to feel like a cheat because we've gotten so much, oh, somebody dies, somebody dies, somebody dies mantra. And you know, normally it's, oh, that's interviews, I'll ignore that, whatever, because I don't read the interviews. No, this was the way they've been actively soliciting the book, in the book, in previews, etc., for months. So they overhyped it. Now, for the rest of the story involved, I loved seeing Alex Powers actually using his powers. He's one of the members of the Future Foundation, or whatever it's called. And I loved seeing, because where we left off is those kids are all in jeopardy. And it was nice to see those kids actually trying to fight back, not, oh, woe is us kind of a thing. And you talk about how Hickman has done a great job with Valeria. He has, but a lot of these other characters get their moment to shine. I mean, the bit with Leech I thought was great, excellent kind of a reveal, kind of saw it coming, but still, it was well done. I loved seeing Valeria take charge. I mean, that is a future leader of the Fantastic Four right there, folks. Don't know when, don't know how, but sooner or later, she's going to be the one running the show. And it'll be interesting to see if she does it just as a super scientist, or if she winds up with powers, you know, in the future, or, you know, or whatever. But, I mean, great, great stuff there. And the interaction between Sue and Namor, I talked about that the last time we mentioned the book. Great stuff there, good dynamic. Hickman, I don't know how far back he's read Fantastic Four, but if he hasn't read the whole thing, I would be shocked. He has such a fundamental understanding of it that it just oozes out of his scripts, and I'm loving that. I thought this did have a powerful ending. Like we said, I wasn't convinced a character died.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. But, you know, how much do you want to knock Hickman for something that was completely out of his, and the issue itself, for something that was completely out of his control? But, you know, now you got to have the conversation of the way that this was marketed, how is that going to affect the people who are buying this issue? Because, you know, you went, the first shop you went to, they quote-unquote didn't have a copy, although you saw that they had copies behind the counter.
A copy that they moved, yeah, which presumably was spoken for, but still kind of annoyed me.
You know, we saw on the forum some, you know, reports that one of the listeners had a local shop where they took a whole bunch of the copies that they got in, put them in Mylar bags, and marked them up to $7.99 the day that they came out. You know, this is the kind of thing. And, you know, maybe this isn't as big of a problem for someone who's never read a comic before, you know, but they read it and they've been told that there's a death. So they kind of see the kind of setup at the end and they're like, oh, well, that character died. When, you know, you and I know that there's no way that that character actually died, you know, but then it's like, you know, does somebody then feel cheated, you know, when it turns out that there was no actual death in there? Or are they even buying the book still, you know, when that's revealed in a year? Who knows? Maybe that's not a big an issue. I'm more concerned with, you know, if there are shops that are price gouging for this issue the day it comes out, if you actually do have someone who wanders into a comic book shop because they saw that this on the news and they get turned away because it's either sold out or, you know, it's been marked up to double cover price or something. You know, that's the kind of thing that will turn somebody off of comics forever and, you know, just have them telling negative stories about their comic shop experience around the water cooler to other people.
What about if they go in for this? They pick it up. They're looking around. They see all these Captain America books. It's like, I thought he died. Yeah, he came back. Well, there's Superman books. I thought he died. Yeah, he came back. So, I mean, there's ample evidence on the rack for that, and I think that's bad. The other thing that I think may be a point of confusion is if you go just past the last page of the story and flip it, we get what is either an end title page or a next issue preview, kind of a blurb. Because I read it, and I'm like, well, is this for this issue, or is this what's coming next? Or, and that may confuse people, too, because, again, it sets expectations. And all of my complaints on this go down to exactly, you know, everything you were just saying of how is it marketed? How is that going to be perceived by the mass audience? How many bridges is that going to burn for comics and fandom, just in general, of, hey, we were cheated yet again? And how much of this can we, if any, blame for Hickman? And Hickman, I think, is presumably completely blameless on this. but I cannot give it a 5 out of 5 rating, given how it was overhyped, polybagged, and cash-grabbed six ways to Sunday. And I don't feel it delivered on the hype.
Yeah, I hold Hickman blameless in this, but, you know, from a pure story standpoint, I think he's telling a great story here. You know, you take his FF run, and like I said, it's one of the top five FF runs in the history of the title, in my opinion. You know, someone who's been reading, you know, like...
Is the other ones up there? Because I agree with you. And for me,
well, obviously Lee and Kirby,
obviously,
right, and probably, you know, to me the John Byrne run,
that was the other one that came to my mind. Yeah,
maybe one of the, you know, when Wade was doing it one of the times, and it's like beyond that, I can't, maybe top four in that case.
Okay, I just wanted to see if there was one that I was missing. It's like okay, yeah, Lee Kirby obviously, Byrne obviously. I hadn't really thought about the Mark Waid one, but I totally agree with that. Totally rocked. There were one or two other short runs that I think were
good. And
it's
not saying that this is fourth, you know, either.
No. You know, but that's where the fight's coming out at, yeah.
If I actually, you know, went back and looked at it in depth, you know, just off the top of my head, I would probably put it number three behind Lee Kirby and John Byrne.
Yeah.
You know, right now. But I haven't gone back and re-examined all the different storylines, so, you know, I just kind of throw out the top five to kind of like leave that fudge factor in there, right?
No,
maybe there's something I'm forgetting, although if it was one of the greatest runs, maybe I shouldn't be forgetting it, right?
Well, no, I'm completely in agreement, but I mean, we're at almost 600 issues for this thing. There were a ton of runs. It's hard to kind of keep all that in your mind at once or whatever, so this is a definitive run. This is a definitive issue in a definitive run. And I don't hold Hickman the least bit blameless. I think he delivered on an excellent story here. Epting did a great job with the visuals and stuff. I can't give it a 5 out of 5 on just philosophical reasons. Again, it technically did not deliver what was promised, but the promise was the problem. So I'm going to have to go with a 4, but it's not even a 4+. It's a 4.9999999999.
I'm right there with you on that. And, you know, and as a matter of fact, it's funny because, you know, you look at that last title page, and, you know, I think that is just the title of the story, and they put it at the end because, you know, obviously the last stand of, you know, X
that character,
you know, it would give away, you know, the ending of the story if you put it at the front. I would have personally thought maybe if you would have pasted that in at the bottom of the previous page, you know, as the story title, may have been a little more effective. But, you know, even that wording, the last stand of character, as opposed to the death of character or whatever, it leaves that question open. Again, I have no problem with that. I like the fact, I hope I'm right, that the character didn't really die, because I would much rather see one of those old style cliffhangery kind of things coming out where it's like, and here's how they didn't die and this is what they did, because I can think of four or five ways that they could get out of that situation, and I'm not a writer, you know?
Yeah. So, well, I guess for me it comes down to we clearly did not see a death. We saw, again, death seemed almost potentially inevitable, or certainly in the cards, where the scene cuts off. And when I read the last stand of that character at the end of the thing, if I had read that and hadn't known, ooh, you know, big death, this hadn't been polybagged, whatever, I'd been thinking, wow, that next issue, we're going to see the last stand of that character. We're going to see the next few moments.
And we're going to see how they – well, actually, I'd be thinking, I'm going to see how they get out of this one.
Yes.
Because that's really what is the interesting part, is not – to me, killing somebody, that's just a cheap shot.
Yeah.
You know, some of these characters, what's really the heroic thing is you put them into the face of those, you know, insurmountable odds, and what do they do that defines them to get
to
out of
that yes.
hopeless situation, you know – that's the thing that's interesting. And that's what I think ultimately we're going to see in flashback. In fact, what will disappoint me is if the character is actually dead. You know, mm-hmm. It's like that would be disappointing to me because I think it would be just a waste of a great story opportunity to show a really strong conclusion and how do they get out of this kind of thing for the character.
Well, and again, I think even money is on issue 600 a year from now, once they've reverted back to the title and numbering, to be kind of this character back giving us that here's what really happened. And again, I loved this issue. I really wish Marvel's marketing department had not gotten a hold of it and gone hog wild. Did they get oodles of sales from it? Yeah. Is that good in the short term? Totally. Is that good in the long term? Not at all. We are not in a market that can sustain that kind of blatant pipe and cash grabbing and not have... Back in the 90s when all that kind of stuff was happening left, right, and center, there was a fallout from that, and we cannot afford any kind of a major fallout in this kind of market where it would just take a few thousand readers to leave and suddenly a whole ton of titles start collapsing. A bunch of stores and publishers could start collapsing. This is a small pond. The reverberations on that would be quick and harsh.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I shot an email out to the guy who wrote that CNN article about this storyline mm-hmm. that, you know, he talked to me and quoted me in that.
Yeah.
I asked him what he thought of this. You know, we kind of traded a couple of emails back and forth, and he's like, you know, I kind of made the point of, yeah, you know, marketing, you know, same kind of stuff. I'm really disappointed in what they did. And he said, but, you know, that's their job. that's what they do, and they were successful.
Is their job to sell that issue or to sell that title and to sell comics?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm just saying the outside view of that is, well, they, you know, got people to buy boatloads of this issue, which normally you only get by renumbering it to a number one, which will be coming up in two issues.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is kind of sad that the way that you sell issues is through gimmicks instead of story. But that said, the story's been great for a long time, and people have not been flocking to the title to buy it. So, you know, desperation.
Yeah, again, I can't fault them for having to pull some of these marketing ploys because this title has been selling, you know, less than it could and less than it should. So, like I said, I couldn't hold out to wait until my shipment that would come Monday for fear of it being spoiled. I'm glad I got it Thursday night and read it Thursday night because on Friday I did have it spoiled.
Yeah, I actually popped over and got it on Tuesday and read it Tuesday night, and first thing Wednesday morning I had it spoiled for me.
Yeah.
Or would have had it spoiled for me had I not gotten it.
That's the better way to phrase it because that applies to me too. Shall we move on to DC?
Indeed.
And here we are a week later with our DC pick of Shazam number one. Now, we really haven't seen a whole lot of Freddy, who became Shazam back in that Trial of Shazam series a few years ago, since he became Shazam. I mean, he showed up a little in that Cry for Justice, but other than that, just kind of let the character sit in limbo and stuff, which I was really disappointed with. And this is another one of those one-shots that I felt told a good story, but other than reestablishing kind of the status quo for Freddy, Mary, and Billy, it was an enjoyable story. I'd recommend it to Shazam family fans, but it was just kind of there. I mean, would you kind of agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds you about what happened with Shazam, because I had forgotten that Billy and Mary lost their powers and, you know, all that kind of... I mean, like you said, it's been so long that since he's been in the public eye that I kind of forgot some of the bits there. And another thing I would say is it's good for Shazam fans. And also, if you read this, plan on picking up Titans starting with number 32. Because, again, you know, these one-shots are being used as lead-ins to try to get more readers on the regular monthly... various monthly series, and this one is to be continued in Titans number 32.
Well, so I would say it's to be followed on in Titans. You know, I don't think that this story really continues in. I think it ended and a new one begins.
You know, I'm just reading the "to be continued" in Titans number 32 on the last page.
No, and I get that. That's exactly how they phrased it. I'm just saying for our listeners, they don't necessarily need to stay away from this out of the fear of being obligated to go buy the Titans stuff. Because I felt this gave a very good standalone story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it had a teaser for that next issue of Titans. And certainly, that's where, you know, it looks like Freddy's going to show up next. But that story really didn't start in this issue. And it's not like kind of that part one of X kind of a thing. So I think this kind of towed the line between, like, the Wonder Girl, which was very much a standalone, and say either the Steel or the Starman Congorilla one, which did have, you know, okay, follow up on, you know, in this other title. The one thing, though, with this that really did not sit well with me was in the intro scene where Freddy's kind of saying where he's been lately. I really didn't like the explanation of basically he just needed to get away for a while after what happened in Star City, referencing the whole Justice League Cry for Justice series. And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I don't really consider, you know, running away kind of a heroic trait. And I felt that kind of undercut the character quite a bit, particularly all the character building they did back in that Trial of Shazam series a couple of years ago.
I guess I kind of, that kind of washed over me. I was more taken up in what Mary did, and then I do like how Eric Wallace flipped that around and made it, you know, he kind of strings you along thinking that one thing happened and then he brings it back so that, oh, that's not what you really thought and it was better. So I enjoyed the story, but all of these one-shots have been kind of middling for me just on the, and I can understand DC. I mean, DC wants to drum up the readership in their ongoing titles. So, you know, doing these one-shots is a good way to do that.
I can understand that, but think back to a while back when we reviewed, it was either that Cloak and Dagger one-shot, or maybe it was just the Dagger one-shot, I forget what they called it. But I know I left that one-shot thinking, wow, this creative team has a really cool take on these characters. I want to read more of these characters by this creative team, or at least this take, maybe by another creative team that could kind of duplicate that success. And I haven't felt that way really about any of these one-shots from DC. I came in really liking the Shazam family and stuff, but I left this thinking, well, okay, it was just another issue, not, wow, I wish they would do a Shazam ongoing. And that, I think, was the failure of the whole bunch of one-shots so far.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I'm completely on board with the Freddie Freeman as Shazam thing, personally. You know, that's probably at the root of why I'm a little ambivalent about this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even with, you know, the Trial of Shazam and all that kind of stuff. I mean, to me, it's like, you know, Billy Batson is Shazam, and I like Mary Marvel, and I, it's like, and I didn't mind Freddy as one of the Marvel family, but, you know, kind of depowering the others and putting Freddie Freeman in the spotlight. They did it. I don't understand why. And
there's a certain stealing of the mantle aspect almost, particularly since Billy is still around wanting to be a hero.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's Freddie now with the power and not Billy, I agree, kind of is a little awkward.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a bad story. Like you said, I mean, it was a fine story. And I like how Billy and Mary are acting, you know, without their powers. I mean, they're actually acting, especially given that they have no powers, in a very heroic fashion. And, you know, I hadn't thought of it, you know, but now that you pointed out, you know, it's like they are acting probably more heroic than Freddy was,
mm-hmm.
given that he has powers. So, I don't know. I was kind of going back to our, you know, start something out as a three and then something needs to move it up or down.
Uh-huh.
I didn't really have anything here that was pulling it up much beyond that three.
That's exactly where I was. And it actually came a little close, not very, but a little close to getting that two, in so much as Freddy acting unheroically and then kind of the bait part of the bait and switch they did at one point with one of the characters there, where they almost didn't buy me over on the, oh, that was just acting and not really the way the character felt.
Yeah, I kind of liked that part just because I was like sort of outraged at first. It's like, that's really out of character. Why would the character do that? And then when it turns out that it was just acting, it was like, oh, okay, I can see now. It was more of a relief. Let's put it that way.
I had is I knew why the character was acting that way, and I didn't think it was out of character given some of the previous appearances of that character. So I bought into that hook, line, and sinker, and then it took them most of the rest of the episode, or the issue, I mean, to kind of, okay, I'll go with this is how that character really feels now. And that was one that, again, if they, and it took me a while, it's like, well, wait a sec, is, you know, how is this really playing out or whatever? They were too effective at the beginning of the story, I guess, is part of the problem there. At least for me.
Yeah, I was never that other stuff that happened to the character. This is really awkward when you're trying to like go with this kind of stuff without naming names. But you know, I never was really a big fan of that particular arc with the character.
Oh, I hated it, but they had done it, and I was worried they were going to stick with it. So I was glad they didn't. But when they start out that way, and I'm buying into it, it's like, you know, and then they do a left turn or whatever. I mean, I'd like to see them take this group of characters and position them better, because really I think everything they did as far back as the JSA stuff with Black Adam going into 52 on forward, they've got about a half a dozen characters here that have the potential between the group of them to support an ongoing. Pull in some of the other Fawcett, you know, heroes and villains as kind of a supporting cast, and they could easily do almost like a Birds of Prey-ish kind of a quasi-group, but not really a team book with these characters.
Uh-huh.
They just have never actually tried to pull that off, and it seems like such an obvious direction to go in, at least to me. I'm hoping that 2011 is when they kind of turn around this group of characters and position them better, get them into an ongoing, get them in the limelight, and really let them all shine as best they can.
Yeah.
So, solid 3 for me.
Yeah, but, I mean, again, this is something, if you're a big Captain Marvel fan, and I guess you're a big Captain Marvel fan and really are okay with the Freddie Freeman thing, then I would say you well, you know, if you're one of those people, you already have this. So, you know.
This is not something I would recommend as a starting point for this group of characters.
Yeah, it's not great of a jump-on point. I think you're right.
Yeah, it doesn't show them at their best, and it doesn't show them in a kind of a classic way. It was a good story, it was an average story, but there are better ones to jump on with.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Shall we move over to our other book?
IDW, Infestation. Now, this is an interesting one. IDW is trying to do a crossover between a lot of the different licensed titles that they have. And I kind of like, you know, they brought Dan Abnett and Annie Lanning on to write this. The thing that I was actually kind of pleasantly surprised about when I opened it up, because they hadn't really pitched it in this way, at least not that I saw, was you know, the covert vampire or the covert vampiric operations team from IDW, which I've read their series that have come out previously, was taking center stage here. And the basic story is there's a zombie infestation coming through this portal from another dimension. So it's kind of like, you know, in Marvel Zombies, and I'm not trying to draw a parallel to Marvel Zombies, but, you know, like the Marvel Zombies thing comes from a different kind of parallel universe kind of thing. It's, you know, that's how they do it. So this is, you know, there's some zombie infestation coming, and it's trying to get into a bunch of different universes. And that's that's cool because that gives them the excuse then to cross it over into the other books, which are the Star Trek books that IDW licenses, the Ghostbusters books, the G.I. Joe books, and this is the one I have the problem with, the Transformers books. Okay, so, I mean, I really am fine that Transformers are a big license for them, okay? But when they took this particular book, and there's, I'm going to put a little spoiler here, but when they took this book and they had the zombie virus infecting robots, so that assumedly when they cross it over with Transformers, they can have a robot Transformer become a zombie, my suspension of disbelief was completely shattered. You know, it's like,
I actually like that aspect, yeah, because I think they set up the mixing of magic and technology and how, you know, that's just not a good idea. And I thought they sold that concept, and it's like, okay, they're doing it in preparation for the Transformers infestation stuff for the exact reasons you mentioned. But at least they set it up here versus it coming out of left field in that miniseries.
Yeah, I wasn't buying it. For me, I would have rather if, you know, it just went into the Transformers universe and maybe the Transformers were fighting against the zombies. But I mean, I'm a long time. I do lots of zombie stuff, and you know, making a zombie virus something that infects a robot, I wasn't down with that. That bothered me.
I can understand that because it is a huge stretch. I thought they at least set it up well. Had they not gone that way, I'd have been just as happy, though. Now, unlike you, I have not read any of the Covert Vampiric Operations stories before this, and really until recently didn't realize it was going to be pulling them into this. If I had known that back when they first solicited this stuff, I might have actually gone and picked up some of the miniseries or whatever on those just to get a little background.
Yeah, and that's something that they missed out on. Because, again, until I opened this book up and saw the Covert Vampiric Operations, I had no idea that they were being featured as key players or as, you know, kind of spotlighted characters in this.
Yeah, because they're definitely the leads here. Now, I also have not read any of the Zombies versus Robots stuff, which they reference on, like, the third page and as kind of part of the backstory for this.
I've read some of that by Ashley Wood, and I don't recall any robots turning into zombies in that either, so maybe I missed that.
Well, there may not have been. That's not the part they were referencing. But
no, I know. I'm just saying it's like those were regular zombies.
Yeah. Well, and that would have been a good place to have set that up. But again, I felt the way they mixed the magic and tech here kind of made sense to at least make something as insane as zombie robots at least almost plausible. The part that got me, though, was they're almost crossing over yet another property with this, and that's Stargate. Because there's an aspect of this interdimensional portal that looks exactly like the Stargate. Now, only a little so on page 3, but man, you get to page, I think it's 29. They even have the little chevrons that lock into place and light up and stuff as if it's exactly the Stargate. So I thought that was kind of a interesting little, you know, Easter egg or whatever. And there is an aspect of the covert vampiric operations that, at a high conceptual level, has some parallels with the Stargate stuff. But for me, that was kind of just a, hey, that's funny. Again, I liked how they set up the concept of the zombie robots, and again, that's a hard sell. I can definitely see where not everyone's going to buy that, and that's cool. I liked how they had the 2-page previews of the different miniseries that are going to come after this. The Transformers, the Star Trek, the G.I. Joe, and the Ghostbusters one. I also liked how they kind of set up that if there is higher tech or higher magic in any of those other universes than the starting one here, that could cause problems. Because, of course, Transformers, that implies high tech. Star Trek, obviously high tech. Ghostbusters, definitely high magic or supernatural. G.I. Joe, not really much in either as far as I know, but, you know, we'll see what happens there. overall, I thought in these 32 pages, they set up a lot of story, a lot of characters, just with the covert vampiric operations and stuff, set up the premise, moved things along, got some good action, and this read very much like a pilot episode of a TV series. Ironically enough, I would say kind of like a Stargate TV series, but that's just me. It's as if Stargate wanted to go after the Buffy audience. It was, again, surprisingly heavy on the backstory for both Robots vs. Zombies and the covert vampiric operations, which I hadn't really anticipated it to be that kind of entrenched with it. But it worked. Like I said, if I'd known that earlier, I might have considered getting some of those back issues. I still might, but at this point, I don't feel a huge need to do so. I think they set up these characters well. They're interesting enough, but not ones that I feel, oh gosh, I've just got to go get all the backstory and stuff. There was a few places where I felt the pacing was a little awkward, and one or two where it's like, wow, that character speaks exposition very well. Particularly on page 8, where Britt is giving the backstory of Cross. And it's like, well, after you've done this, 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 and that kind of a thing. It's like, okay, I know we need that. I know it's hard to fit in. But it was just a little, I don't say clunky, because it wasn't. It just felt like very clear exposition. And again, a lot of that was needed in this because they needed to set up a ton of characters, a ton of situations, and get this to work as a springboard for the other miniseries and then come back into this in a couple of months. And again, they were very effective at that. This is something that I think in lesser hands would have been really, really bad, and I was really pleased with this. This definitely stepped up above average for me. It's a very clear 4, and for something that's launching a quasi-crossover, because I really don't think we're ever going to see in this the Ghostbusters meet either G.I. Joe, Transformers, or Star Trek, or, you know, none of those are going to cross-pollinate or whatever in terms of the story. The story is going out to those and then coming back to this. So using this fifth group or whatever as kind of the story glue makes sense. But again, I found this really interesting, really enjoyable, and much better than frankly the concept almost has any right to be, because it's like, ooh, let's have zombies everywhere. It's like, okay, we've seen that. So they've pulled this off. They've done a good job.
Now, are you getting the other series?
Yes. The other miniseries after this. The only of these properties I've been following has been Star Trek.
Right. So I didn't buy anything other than... I didn't pre-order anything other than the main first issue and last issue, which are, I guess, sort of bookends to this thing. After reading this, I'm sort of interested in getting the Star Trek one. I'm definitely going to get the Star Trek 2 issues. I like that. And I might get the G.I. Joe issues, because, again, I don't necessarily know and follow the G.I. Joe characters, but it'd be kind of interesting to see them go against the zombies. I have zero interest in seeing the Transformers turn into zombies. And I'm not particularly interested in the Ghostbusters one either.
Yeah, those are the two that, I mean, the Transformers one, that's just, I agree, it's a hard sell concept-wise. You got robots, you got zombies, really. The Ghostbusters one, I wasn't impressed with the art in the two-page thing, and that just seems a little too obvious of a, okay, they fought ghosts, now let's have them do zombies. I really think the G.I. Joe... you know, okay, let's have a military group fight zombies has a lot of potential, particularly with that group of military guys. And I was really pleased, for the most part, with the two-page thing we got of the Star Trek one. Other than Spock just kind of sitting back watching the whole thing. It's like, really? You're not going to do anything? I'm sure in a couple of pages he'll have a quick synopsis on what's going on, how to fix it, etc. But I can definitely see where the sales on the four different miniseries may wind up being very different.
Yeah, it seems like you're not going to need to read all of them, which is a good thing, right?
Well, yeah, because I certainly think that all four of them are going to run in parallel without intertwining, and then the ramifications of those four come back in issue 2 of this.
Yeah, but, you know, to me, I just can't get the whole robot thing. So, I mean, I'll have to pick them up at the shop because I didn't order them, and they're coming out too fast, I think, to add them to my pull with DCBS. Maybe the G.I. Joes aren't coming out till March I can get, but the I think the Star Trek one comes out next week. So, number one, and then the second one comes out a couple of weeks after that. They got kind of funny shipping on them.
Well, they're doing kind of two in February, two in March, and they staggered the weeks.
Yeah.
Which I think kind of makes sense. But, you know, again, we'll see how that pans out for them.
But, I mean, any given series, and they have the issues coming out only a couple of weeks apart, which is maybe good because it'll keep people's interest up. But if you're buying that particular one, you're buying two issues in that month.
Right. But it gives them a weekly run of the infestation stuff pretty much, you know, from now through through April, or beginning of April.
Right.
And I like how they had the checklist on the back page, on the back cover and stuff. Because they have the covers and stuff. It's like, oh, I need to look for that one.
I'm just thinking maybe have gone, you know, number one, number one, number one, number one, you know, instead of the way they did it. But, you know, 1-1-2-2-1-1-2-2 is the way they did it. Again, it's just, you know, for the wallet of somebody who's not got that big of a budget, you know, if you just want to get, you know, part of it, you're going to get hit for a decent amount of coin in any given month.
In fairness, though, they are skipping, I think, the regular issues of the various titles in those months, so as not to overload of, hey, get all the regular G.I. Joe and the Infestation stuff, or all the regular Transformers and... at least I know they're doing that with Star Trek, and I'm pretty sure G.I. Joe, I'm not sure about the other two, but I think that's how they're doing it. But I think this is an interesting idea. I'm curious to see how it pans out for them, and see where it goes from there.
I'm kind of I'll give it a 4 with a reservation. You know, it would have been I'll give it a low 4. And I would have given it a stronger 4 if they wouldn't have tried to turn a robot into a zombie.
Got a solid 4 out of me. Again, I thought they sold that concept surprisingly well. But I again totally concede it's not an easy buy for zombie robots. But yeah.
I flipped through the Transformers issue number one on the rack on Wednesday and put it back. So.
I can understand that. So I got a ton of other comics this week. There's one, though, I want to talk about a little bit, and that's the Blockbusters of the Marvel Universe number one. It's a one-shot. It's a handbook kind of a thing, and it goes over kind of the mind-blowing events of the Marvel Universe. And I was going through the list as I was flipping through it, and I'm like, really? You picked that? I mean, they've got, I'm not sure how many pages here, but I've got to think that if a group of fans were to get together either on a podcast or on at a comic book store and say, okay, what are the top 30 or 40, you know, events of the Marvel Universe? I'm pretty sure Battletide never would have come up on that list in any shop in the U.S., maybe in the U.K. And there are a couple others here. It's like I was just...
Oh, that was some Marvel U.K. thing with, like, that robot guy with the...
Deathlok.
Yeah, Deathlok.
Yeah, the only U.S. character that I think showed up in there was... I think it was maybe Hercules... And maybe Psylocke or somebody, but I mean, while it was available in the U.S., I actually have all those issues and stuff. I'm like, really? That's something you felt was worth a page or so? Actually, two? No, just a page here, actually. In this, I mean, I was shocked by, again, the choices they had there. So very disappointed in that. It was, I mean... Some of them were very obvious.
Death's Head, not Deathlok, right?
Yes, you're right. Death's Head. My mistake.
Written by Abnett and Lanning, though. I'm like looking the thing up on...
Yeah, well, like I said, I got a lot of the Marvel UK stuff. They weren't bad, but I wouldn't say that's a pivotal thing of the Marvel Universe, since most people don't know about it, haven't read it. They also had like a Howard the Duck story that went for an issue, and one or two other things that just, wow, these seem almost completely random. And I was going through, they have a large appendix at the back of other events that they didn't think were worthy of doing a full entry on. And there were a couple of those, Contest of Champions, and I'm trying to think of Secret War. Secret Wars was one of them that they did Secret War, Secret Wars plural, I mean the original word. But yeah, there were a couple that just didn't make sense for them to kick, you know, into the appendix and not in the main thing. So I was disappointed with that issue. Or at least, you know, how they picked their things and why they picked what they picked. So anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
No, I caught up on my Avengers books. I'm going to start a thread on the forum to talk about them.
And, actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I got 51 books this week. 50, actually. They had the weekly shipping, so that was the 51st. Anyways, there were a ton of Avenger books this week.
Yes.
There's I Am an Avenger, there's Avengers, there's, I think it was...
Secret Avengers, I think, came out.
New Avengers, Secret Avengers, Thunderbolts, which you could argue is an Avengers book, sort of, plus Cap, Thor, I mean, and there were, like, every other X book came out this week. You know, X-Men, X-Men Forever, Uncanny X-Men, X-Force, New Mutants, Namor, Magneto, it's like, come on, guys, space some of this stuff out. I was shocked how heavy of a week it was for Marvel, particularly in the Avengers and X-Men categories. But as you were saying about the Avengers stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'll start a thread. There was somebody mentioned, and this is on the forum, that people in general tend to talk a lot about comics when they're solicited. And, you know, we do that too. We have the preview show and all that. But, you know, I kind of look at the preview show more about, this is cool, it's coming out, make sure that you tell your shop, you know, and make sure you get something ordered, as opposed to pre-discussing in too great a detail, although we do tend, you know, sometimes you will, in a comic shop kind of situation, get dragged down into that, but, you know, talking about the details of the story. But, you know, the point then was made that, you know, once the actual story comes out, people are like sick of talking about it because they've already been talking about it for 3 months. So I thought, yeah, there's a good point there. So having some threads on the forum to be talking about, you know, and you have spoilers in them, that's fine. You know, it's just like, you know, hey, here's stuff on the latest, you know, what's going on in the Avengers, you know, what's going on in Thor, what's going on in whatever book, you know, Superman, Batman, you know.
Just if they're going to have spoilers, let's make sure that's in the topic header. Is to what issue you need to be up on, to not have stuff spoiled.
So, you know, it's just something interesting to have a conversation about. And, you know, I think that somebody was somewhere, I was talking to someone, and they were talking about Master of Kung Fu, and it occurred to me as I'm reading some of the Secret Avengers that have Shang-Chi and his father. And, you know, they kind of gave his father a new name now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of why they can't reprint the Shang-Chi comics. Because his father was originally Fu Manchu, which is a character created by Sax Rohmer. And there was some licensing agreement that had to have been with the Sax Rohmer estate. Because whenever you'd read the old Shang-Chi comics, it'd always say, you know, based on characters created by Sax Rohmer. Or featuring, I can't remember what it was based on, or featuring characters created by Sax Rohmer. And, you know, I think now they don't have the license or the right to do that. That's why you don't see Shang-Chi Essentials or reprints of a lot of that really cool Master of Kung Fu stuff that came out in the past. And now they're bringing him back into the universe, and they're kind of just saying, okay, well, we're just going to take his father and we call him Shang-Chi's father, and now we're giving him this other name and this kind of other backstory so that they can actually use their character now. You know, Shang-Chi was an original Marvel Comics creation, so they can use that character.
Yeah, that kind of character ownership and stuff like that can get really interesting at times. and really limiting at times in terms of, again, when they cross some stuff over and whatnot. I think that's why when they did the, I think it was the Shazam showcase at DC, they had to skip issue 25 because that was using the Isis character that Filmation owns.
Right. And, you know, same thing with, you know, they did the one version of the Godzilla Essential, but they can't do that anymore because, you know, they don't have the license for Godzilla. Or when you have reprints of, like, Marvel Team-Up or Marvel 2-in-1, you can't do the issues where Spider-Man or the Thing cross over with, you know, Conan or Red Sonja or somebody like that that's a licensed character that they no longer have the rights to.
Yeah, yeah.
So, just interesting.
Cool. Anything else then?
That's it.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Legion of Superheroes Annual Number 1 from DC, The Amazing Spider-Man Number 653 from Marvel, and Uncle Scrooge Number 400 from Boom Studios.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.